Marshall and Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
I agree that breaking up big tech companies won't solve the problem, because I assume that we would break them up along the lines of their business units, their products. Right. And so, like, take Amazon, for example. If you so by the way, I still think we probably should break them up, because they've just gotten way too powerful, and it would be probably a net benefit. It probably would be helpful, but I don't think it's going to solve the speech problem for this reason. So you've got Amazon and you've got AWS. Okay, you fork the cap tables. You've now got two cap tables. It doesn't change anything. You got the same executives running these companies. Right. They make decisions the same way. So, you know, instead of having a speech cartel of five companies, you now got a speech cartel of 10 companies. It doesn't change anything. The problem is fundamentally the cartel. The cartel is what needs to be busted up.
We have an awesome show today. We have brought David Sachs, the founder of Craft Ventures. He was at Yammer, PayPal. He's a Silicon Valley investor, and you probably know him from the All In podcast with Chamath Palihapitiya, Jason Calacanis, and David Friedberg. For the purposes of our show today, he has been very prolific on three topics that we are obsessed with on this show: the future of the state of California. There's this whole debate right now about whether the future of America is going to be written in California, in New York City, in Florida. He is in the interesting category of he's critiquing the status quo in the state, but he's not leaving. So getting his perspective on that was great. We then go on to talk about China, TikTok, Clubhouse, the NBA, all the stories you're going to keep hearing about for the next few years. And we finish up with a really fascinating discussion about free speech on the internet. You all know this, I'm obsessed with this topic. And actually, we'll get into this a little later, he started to convince me of a slightly different perspective than one I've heard today.
I loved having David on the podcast, Marshall, because he gave us an actually unique insight onto almost every topic that we're interested in. You know, around China and Silicon Valley, they've got a lot of these guys have their stock answers, and it's frankly just not that interesting. And he was talking about industry-specific stuff. He was talking about how tech companies are going to have to choose, which, again, is actually pretty taboo out there. Same thing whenever it came to free speech. He's somebody who actually wants to see free speech on the internet, and then talked exactly about the legal mechanisms on how we might be able to make it happen. We talked about California and how exactly the tech industry hasn't really seen itself be inserted into politics and how that's definitely going to change. So I got a lot out of this podcast. I think that you guys all will too. At the same time, it's also a very, very, very special episode, because this is episode 100, which is around the time, I believe, that Joe Rogan started to take his podcast a little bit more seriously. So just think about us in the context of what that development cycle. We cannot thank those of you who have been here since episode 1 enough. Those of you who have even been here since episode 99, it's all good. Welcome to the Realignment family. It's been amazing watching this thing grow at literally a stratospheric rate, especially since we relaunched in the last couple of months. So thank you all. Seriously, it's awesome. We've got big, big plans.
We've got really exciting things coming. We've been previewing all this in the Substack. Definitely go and subscribe in your show notes. But there's really exciting things coming down the tube. And thank you so much for being there with us on the journey.
That's right. And you guys know the deal. Subscribe to therealignment.substack.com. That's where you can ask questions. You get weekly transcripts, all your realignment necessities. And make sure you take a look at our bookshop, which is linked there in the show notes, as well as within our Substack. That's where you guys can help support an independent bookstore during COVID-19. And you can buy the books of anybody who appears on the show or the many different recommendations that we put out. If you guys want, follow Marshall and I on Instagram and on Twitter. We put book recommendations out there all the time. Really helps the show and really helps us. Last but not least, give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. Really helps other people find the show. You can also ask us a question there if you want to within your 5-star rating. And with that, let's get to the question and answer period.
Because because it is our 100th episode, we are going to break for tradition and we are going to read a 2-star review for you. This is an answer to the critics who believe that we are inorganic and only read our greatest hits. We are bringing it to you here. A quick question for the audience and for Sagar too. Who rates a 2-star? It's sort of weird.
No. Just give me a fucking 1-star.
Yeah, just give it 1-star. Just give me a 2-star mark 174-274-26474. That was a cowardly rating you just gave us. So here's the question. Why is this podcast pretending to be broadcast media? And a quick note on this. The reason why we're answering this question is a lot of people share the critique that Mark is about to give us. So we thought it'd be useful to just answer this rather than responding randomly on YouTube or to texts that we get from our friends. So question is, why is this podcast pretending to be on broadcast media? Marshall and Sagar, if you're reading this, don't interrupt the guests and make them explain terms. It's a podcast. I can pause and Google if I need to. 2, don't cut off the guests at the end like you're running out of time on the air. It's a podcast. I can pause and finish it later if I need to. Quick context for anyone who has not listened to our episode with Balaji Srinivasan last week. It was a great episode. We went pretty long for the realignment. It clocks in at around 1.5 hours. But unfortunately, we, due to the fact that we have day jobs and there's a schedule, had to cut Balaji off with 5 minutes to go. Hence the offending take. Please go back and listen to hear for yourself if you have not already. But Sagar, what is your reaction to this criticism?
Yeah, okay, Mark. It's not broadcast, but it's not as inorganic as some of you guys might think. And maybe you would like to pause and can Google, but a lot of people can't. A lot of people are driving, people are washing their dishes, people are with their kids or waiting for them at the playground. Who knows? My job as a broadcaster, which is where my training comes from, is to be able to give you as much information in the allotted time that you allow me into your ears and to make sure that you can take away everything that you need from that conversation. If you have to go outside and Google, it's all good. We try as hard as we can in order to keep things in the show notes and more. And I would just say that there's really nobody in the business who does what you're talking about. And the reason I know that is, look, I've been on Joe Rogan's podcast. I used a word which he didn't know, and he interrupted me and said, hey, can you explain that word? I don't know what it means, and our audience won't know what it means. That's called audience advocacy. It's something that we try really, really hard to do here. And the best in the business, they do it making it sound maybe a little bit more natural. So maybe we can work on it from that perspective. But just a peek behind the curtain as to how exactly all that works out.
And the good news, Sagar, is we have 900 more episodes minimum to get better at interjecting without making it seem so direct. So yeah, and just to tie that off, the key thing is, look, what makes us so excited about the prospects of this show after the next 100 episodes is that by then we could spend so much more of our time on the show. But the reality is it's actually very tough to block out an hour and a half during the day to record and then coordinate with Phil and do all this stuff all together. So someday I hope that we could send you guys 6-hour unedited, raw, honestly meandering around our number 3 episode, because that will mean we are making so much money off of this podcast that we don't have to actually work for a living anymore.
That's right. Listen, you give me a $100 million Spotify contract, I'll give you as much time as you need. We'll build you a nice studio. We'll have a little live Jamie Googler for all the stuff that you don't know. We can go as long as you want. But until then, this is just literally something that we do on the side. Luckily, it's actually gotten quite big, which makes it pretty fun, but not quite at the level, really, where it's Marshall or I's full-time job. So that's their peek behind the curtain. All right, as always, a special thank you to the Lincoln Network for sponsoring this podcast. Let's dive in.
David Sachs, welcome to The Realignment.
Good to be here.
Good to see you, David.
Yeah.
David, there are 3 main topics which you've been very prolific about. Future of California, China, technology, and the future of the internet. We are obsessed with these 3 topics, so this is going to be a slightly grab baggy. I can't come up with the perfect narrative to tie all 3 together, so we're just going to dive into it.
Okay, sounds good.
What is the matter with California?
What isn't the matter with California right now? We have the highest poverty rate in the country. We have the highest unemployment, or just about the highest, because of a draconian lockdown policy. We have the most homelessness. I think we've got half of the total homelessness in the United States. We have some of the worst education outcomes in the U.S. I think we're the, at least for disadvantaged students, we're the second worst. The only state that we're ahead of is Alaska. Crime is exploding. We've got district attorneys who don't want to prosecute, particularly in L.A. and San Francisco. We are not doing that great in vaccine administration. We've only, I think we're number 36 out of 50 states. And then we have the worst air quality in the country because of poor fire management. And then on top of all of that, we've got some of the highest tax rates and most burdensome regulations in the country. And that's driving entrepreneurs out of the state in droves, most notably Elon Musk, who left for Texas. And I can tell you, being here in Silicon Valley, I'm still here in San Francisco, that tons and tons of people are leaving for new tech hubs like Miami and Austin. So it's a very, it's I think Silicon Valley in particular and California in general are at a very dangerous crossroads. There's some polling on this. 53% of Californians are actually thinking of leaving. I mean, that's like more than half the state is actually thinking about leaving right now. And 63% of Californians think the American dream is dead here. So, I mean, it's pretty staggering when you look at the numbers and the list of problems that we're confronting.
So two obvious follow-ups from there. One, why are you staying? Because the narrative is set for you to leave. And then two, and this is, I suspect, going to be part of your first answer, what are the underlying strengths from your perspective that make California actually viable in the future and make it a state that appears bright?
So the reason why I'm staying, at least for now, I mean, I'd like to see things get better. You know, I'm based in Silicon Valley. I mean, I'm a technology investor, founder. Historically, this has been the place that you had to do that. I mean, it was, the Bay Area was sort of an industry town. In the same way that Hollywood is an industry town for entertainment, and New York is the industry town for finance, and Washington, D.C. is the industry town for politics. So it was the case historically that you had to be here if you wanted to be a serious player in the technology industry. Of course, COVID has changed that now because of remote work, and people have realized they can work from anywhere, they can start companies anywhere. And so more and more people are opting to do that. And so the geographic monopoly that Silicon Valley used to have has now been broken by COVID and the proliferation of work by home and Zoom. And so I think what's happened is the reasons that used to require you to be here in California, they no longer apply, and we only have the downsides. And unless the policymakers react to that very quickly, you're going to see more and more people leave the state.
So, but this is the thing, David. I mean, you are still staying. And so I want to drill down on that. I mean, why stay? Because in a way, in my view, it's like that's an implicit bet that, you know, for all of the Twitter talk, Miami and Austin and all of them are still not going to have that physicality of living in San Francisco and of having, you know, organic run-ins, especially whenever all of this comes about. So do you think that there is still something to be said for staying in San Francisco?
Well, I don't want to over-extrapolate based on COVID. So, you know, I tend to think that this period we're going through is a highly unusual period. It'll probably be over in 3 to 6 months once, you know, everyone gets vaccinated. COVID numbers are already going down very fast. So I kind of want to see what things look like when we get back to normal sort of post-COVID, say after the summer, before making a decision. I mean, like deciding to move out of the state completely would be a big life decision. I want to have a little bit more data before I decide to do that. But regardless of what I decide, it's kind of irrelevant because a lot of other people I know have already made the decision. And, you know, so things are different now than they were just a couple of years ago.
So something I'm curious about is the role higher education plays in tech clusters. So we spoke, we just had Balaji Srinivasan on, we had Joe Lonsdale back in August, we have you, the three of you all went to Stanford. That says something about the role that the presence of literally one of the best universities in the world has played in propagating the strength of the Bay Area. And Texas and Austin obviously has UT, great school. Miami doesn't really have a top tier research university, especially in the comp sci area. How do you think that will play in Miami's long-term development?
Well, I think Stanford was helpful, very helpful in Silicon Valley getting off the ground and becoming the tech hub that it became. And it also kept feeding talent, technical talent into Silicon Valley. It helped sustain the ecosystem. But I don't think it's necessary. Because I think ultimately people can graduate and then go wherever they want to go. And so, it's not like the only engineers in Silicon Valley graduated from Stanford. You know, they came from all over the place. And so If Austin or Miami becomes the main tech hub, people will just go there. You know, they'll go there after graduation. And UT, by the way, isn't bad. And UT can get into a positive feedback loop with the sort of emerging tech industry there, and they can start to help each other. So Stanford was helpful historically. I don't know that it's necessary anymore. What's really necessary is the network. Okay, so there have been various efforts over time, especially internationally, where, you know, like, Putin tried to create a Silicon Valley in Russia, and you've had like other countries try to do it. And it ends up being sort of like a Potemkin Silicon Valley, because you kind of have like all these elements there, but it doesn't quite gel. And I think the thing that people don't understand about Silicon Valley is that there is like a tremendously dense network of trust between a lot of the repeat players. And so, for example, I'm able to write a $10 or $15 million check in a company in a matter of days, you know, and not worry that the founders are going to run away with the money, because I know that there's a seed investor earlier in the cap table than me. And I just call that person up and say, hey, what can you tell me about this company? And he vouches for the company and tells me it's legit, right? And so there's all these things that we just take for granted. I mean, I remember, I did make a movie once in yes. Hollywood, you know.
David made Thank You for Smoking, just so everybody knows. One of my favorite films, actually. Yeah.
And I tried fundraising for a movie, and it was a very different experience. Part of the reason is everyone's worried that, you know, movies just they're going to steal the money, you know. And so it's like a much less trusted ecosystem. So you can kind of put you can sort of put a university there, and you can put a couple of VC firms, but unless you are extending a very organic network of trust that took a long time to build, it's hard to recreate Silicon Valley. But I think the thing that is scary now, or should be scary to the Bay Area, to San Francisco, is that as you look at a place like Austin or Miami, a lot of the key people from the Silicon Valley network are now going there. So you've got Joe Lonsdale in Austin, and of course, Elon Musk is taking his whole empire there. Mm-hmm. And then Keith Raboy and some other folks going to Miami. And so they're bringing the trusted network with them and all of their relationships. And that can make a big difference.
Yeah, that's, it's interesting. I've studied and thought about that for a long time, which is like, what exactly encapsulates the deal flow? Because it's like you said, I mean, there's no real way to like, you can't just plop something down and be like, this is Silicon Valley now. It's like, actually, there's all these like attendant things, universities, and then time spent in the market, and then people who know each other. But something that we actually try to think about here, and at least I do in particular, is like how the government gets involved here in regulation and more, which can play a role in boosting or even, diminishing something. That's something you guys have been talking a lot about on your podcast. You and your co-host, Chamath Palihapitiya, got a lot of energy online to recall Gavin Newsom. It's something you have been, very, very active in. So how exactly do you want to impact the state's politics through policy in order to either save what you're doing, boost what you're doing, save the state, et cetera? Just lay that out for the audience, because a lot of our audience probably listen to Joe Rogan and more. They're very, very fed up with Gavin Newsom. But, lay out the case for what you would replace it with. Like, what's a great California look like?
Well, there's a whole bunch of policy changes that I think we need to make, but I don't think they're necessarily that hard. It just requires us to do things that are common sense and in the general interest. I think the issue with Newsom is that he's revealed himself to be completely in the pocket of these special interests. The donor class in California, it's these big unions. He's completely beholden to them. He'll never stand up to them. I mean, there's really two Gavin Newsoms, okay? There's the one who will appear at press conferences and on Twitter, and he'll always say the right thing as long as the polls are telling him to say it. Then there's the Gavin Newsom that, you know, is the kind of the backroom operator. And, you know, and that's where the real policies get made. And so he'll say things that will be sort of progressive and sort of appealing, you know, on Twitter. But then when you look at the policies that actually get made, it's always for the benefit of these special interests who are his backers. It's the insider's game. You know, if you look at the, you know, the whole French Laundry scandal, to me, the most underreported part of that wasn't just the fact that he was breaking his own lockdown policy by eating at French Laundry. It was who was there at that dinner. It was all a bunch of lobbyists. Those are his friends. Those are his cronies. And that to me is the problem. So the first thing we have to do is send a message to the political class in California that you have to look out for the public interest, not for the exclusively for these special interests. And I think the recall is a shot across the bow. It's the first step in sending that message that these politicians who just want to use each new office as a stepping stone to get to the next level. I mean, that's basically what Newsom's career has been. Mm-hmm. We have to remind them that you got to do things that are in the public good, not just for your backers. So that's step one. I mean, in terms of where we go from here, I think it's just so simple, really. It's actually not. I mean, there's a lot of problems, but number one, we need teachers who teach. You know, we've got an education lobby in California that's trying to shut down all the schools and keep them shut. It's crazy. Even though we now have data from the rest of the country showing that there's no correlation between school reopenings and the spread of COVID. It is long since time that the schools reopen, and they won't even commit to reopening in the fall. Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, Gavin has expressed the view that schools should reopen. But dude, you're the governor. You can't just express an opinion. You got to lead on this issue. You need to go break that union. You know, if they don't get on board with school reopening, you break them the way that Ronald Reagan broke the air traffic controllers union when they shut down the airports. You don't just let that slide, you know, but he'll never double cross his union backers, never. So that's one thing that's very obvious is we got to reopen these schools. Second is crime. We got prosecutors who won't prosecute in this state. Crime is surging out of control. Gun violence is out of control. Homicides are out of control. Burglaries are out of control. And it all goes back to, in San Francisco, we got Chase Abudin. And in LA, they got Gascon. These guys are not enforcing three strikes. They don't believe in three strikes, even though it's the law of the state. A judge just ordered Gascon in LA that he had to enforce three strikes because of the law of the land in California. He will not do it. These guys will not do it. They will not prosecute misdemeanors. And this is where, you know, we had this ballot initiative, Prop 47, which downgraded, you know, a lot of property felonies. They all got downgraded to misdemeanors. Well, here's the problem. The DAs don't want to prosecute misdemeanors. They won't put anyone in jail for that. So they've effectively, I don't think the voters would have supported Prop 47 if they knew the result would be that these crimes wouldn't get prosecuted at all. And so you've seen an explosion of petty theft and burglaries in the state because it's effectively been decriminalized. These are some of, I think, the top level issues. Sure. And they're so easy to fix because, again, we just need prosecutors who will prosecute and teachers who will teach.
So this is, and I'm glad you mentioned Thank You for Smoking for a second, because it's not just as if you're producing a movie. Thank You for Smoking, the book. And the movie is actually a funny, satiric, but serious examination of how the political system in Washington, D.C. works and how there's interlocking lobbyists and think tanks and all these different institutions that work together. So I want you to bring the mentality of Thank You to Smoking to California in the sense that, look, there already was a recall election. I think in 2003, Gray Davis was an ineffective governor, and he was recalled in favor of Arnold Schwarzenegger. Love Arnold, hate Arnold. Things promptly reset after that whole trip was done. So as you're looking at the power structure in California, let's say Chamath had decided to run. Let's see, he runs, he's good faith, tries to do everything he does. What stops the system from resetting? Because that seems to be the recurring problem with outsiders in American politics right now, which is that they try to intercede into systems. And actually, it turns out that the fact that the prisons union in California is deeply entrenched, and turns out the fact that these are mixed together makes it complicated. So can you just bring that framework to how the state works long term?
Yeah, I mean, so you're right that the activism is going to have to be sustained, but I think the start is the shot across the bow, because you have to send a message to politicians who think they can just pay lip service to the public, but actually, again, only champion the policies of their donors and special interests. And so replacing Gavin is not the end. It would just be the beginning, but it's the start. I mean, I think we also need a series of ballot initiatives to go along with that. Mm-hmm. You know, look, I think we got to do something on Prop 47. Prop 47 was a ballot initiative that downgraded all of these property felonies down to misdemeanors.
Right.
And you know, and it was championed at the time that, look, there's too many people who've been put in jail over, you know, small, like petty theft or whatever. But there were some pretty serious crimes that were downgraded to misdemeanor. I mean, like auto theft was basically downgraded. And I mean, it wasn't completely downgraded, but they said that the auto thefts of under $950 in value would be downgraded. Well, the problem is these DAs, they don't want to get into an assessment of what the car is worth. They just basically don't lock people up anymore for auto theft. We've had two recent killings in San Francisco. On New Year's Eve, we had this outrageous episode where two people were killed. Hannah Abe and Elizabeth mm-hmm. Platt. They were just walking in San Francisco, and a driver who was on drugs and was fleeing a crime in a stolen car hit them and killed them. And lo and behold, it turns out that he had been released by the DA about 6 months before and had been arrested four times since then and had been released every single time. And he had been caught on for charges, including auto theft.
Yeah.
And just released. I mean, it's crazy. And so that's the common. Now, the DA could have decided to prosecute him and put him in jail, and he certainly should have. But it's the combination of Prop 47 now giving so much discretion to DAs over these property crimes, combined with these DAs who don't want to put people in jail, that we've got this absolutely lawless situation. You had another, this is just a couple of weeks ago. You had another situation where a young man, Sharia Muscoya, who was a recent graduate of Dartmouth, he actually came here from Kenya, had a young wife and child. He went out jogging and again got hit by someone stealing a car who was drugged out. And again, somebody who had been arrested multiple times and just wasn't kept locked up. It's just outrageous to me that this can keep happening.
Yeah, no, it is complete. I've even seen, I mean, I have my own family who live in San Francisco, and believe me, you know, it's a big problem whenever they were there. And I was always worried about, you know, my sister and her safety. And it's interesting, though, when I'm hearing you talk, and this is something where I've observed this in conversation with a few other guys in Silicon Valley. And since you're there, I'd love your take on it, which is that, look, it's not a secret. A lot of people in Silicon Valley have a lot of money, and yet none of them ever seemed very interested in lobbying or in playing the game in the state of California. So could you explain that to me? Like, I have seen this general complete lack of interest in politics, national and state, by guys who have a lot more money than the lobbyists that they're even up against. And I guess the most obvious thing to me is I'm like, so like, I mean, has your, you know, almost libertarian ideology where you're like, it doesn't matter, and like almost utopianism, has it come back to bite them? Like, do you think that they're going to learn a lesson here, that they need to be a lot more interested in politics after the COVID situation? But also look at the deterioration of the city of San Francisco within just 10 years. I mean, it's crazy.
Yes. No, you're 100% right. I don't think that tech has been as politically active as it should have been. You know, just take an example like AB5, which was the bill.
Yes.
That remember that, you know, Uber and Lyft, Lorena Gonzalez passed a bill that basically would have put them out of business by saying that all their drivers needed to be employees rather than contractors. Even though the drivers didn't want that, they liked the flexible hours and the flexible shifts that just being a contractor gave them. But in any event, Lorena pursued that at the behest of the Teamsters, and because they're not union employees, so she wanted to shut them down. Any event, legislature passes that bill. Gavin Newsom, of course, signs it. Of course, always for the benefit of the unions. And then the people in voted that proposition to basically repeal AB5. And so, but Uber and Lyft had to spend hundreds of millions of dollars to campaign for that. And if they'd maybe just spent a little bit more time, money, and energy getting more involved, and Silicon Valley in general, a few million dollars getting involved in races, you know, then maybe they wouldn't be in that situation. And so, I mean, this is a point that was recently made to me by someone who's active in California politics, basically said, if you guys just got more active, you wouldn't have to spend so much money later cleaning it all up. So I think you're right. I think that people, I think people in Silicon Valley have had a blind spot. I think part of it is because there is that libertarian thread where people, they're anti-politics. And so the way they interpret that is, I'm just going to stay out of politics. It's distasteful. I mean, that's why they get into technologies. They don't want to be involved in politics. They want to, they want to do something. They want to build companies. And then, of course, but Silicon Valley actually is not predominantly libertarian. It's predominantly very liberal. And and I think it's the two sides of Gavin Newsom that I've talked about, which is they're reading the tweets and they pay attention to the press conferences. And frankly, as long as he says the right progressive things, they're not looking too hard at the policies. And that's part of the problem.
Yeah. The real last thing here is the whole we have this broader thesis / idea that California is ill-served by the state of national politics right now. So part of the reason why the state has no real political opposition is every election instantly turns into a issue around, at least the past 4 years, around Donald Trump or a broader conversation around the Republican Party. So you're not able to have a localized political debate in the actual nature of the state. Do you think that given the rise of more outsider candidates, because I'm also curious for your thoughts on Andrew Yang's leading the polls in New York as an example of this, is there going to be an opportunity for heterodox, outside-the-box figures to basically use the Democratic Party as a label, quote-unquote, but they're still running against the establishment in the same way? Because that's something that I'm excited about.
Yeah, I mean, this is the insiders versus outsiders analysis, and I think there is a thirst for outsiders to run. I mean, you've got Andrew Yang. I think that Chamath, there's certainly a groundswell for Chamath to run if he decides he wants to run. I don't think he's decided yet because it would be a big sacrifice and change in his life if he decided to run. But we certainly saw that when he was flirting with that idea, there was a tremendous outpouring of support for that. So yeah, I think the electorate is yearning for these outside candidates who are not beholden to special interests. I think it'd be great if Andrew Yang wins in New York because he's not beholden to anybody. And hopefully he can put the interests of the public first as he sees it, as opposed to, responding just purely to these special interests.
Yeah. And, David, while we have you here, because I'm just thinking about these threads in the industry, and it's something, again, where it comes down to China, where there's this crazy, like, it's like what we were talking about with state politics. At the same time, there's this crazy when you're anti-politics, you actually let yourself be, taken down some very bad roads. And mm-hmm. I think one of those really has been a lot of complicity, looking the other way, trying to enter the Chinese market because of dollars and cents, not necessarily thinking about the Chinese Communist Party. I mean, what is your view on China? Do you think we're in a Cold War with China? If we are, how should American business respond? Should the U.S. government have to get involved as an investor and somebody in the actual business yourself? What do you think?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think that I don't do any business in China. It's just I'm happy about that, I guess. But the reality is, I back startups here in the United States. I think China is definitely a larger issue. I think that Cold War is certainly one historical analogy for what's going on. I think that another historical analogy would be sphere of influence and a great powers rivalry, sort of mm-hmm. pre-World War I. You saw the world prior to the First World War sort of divided up into spheres of influence and trade blocks and that kind of thing. It feels like that's kind of where we're headed towards. It won't be quite like the Cold War, which was a bipolar world. It'll be more of a multipolar world, but it seems like countries will choose which to be client states of one block or the other, and it's going to be there's going to be a lot less free trade than there was in the 20th century.
Yeah, I mean, if we're looking at the list of issues that I feel are the highest priority with China, one would just be the lack of a reciprocal relationship when it comes to technology. Mm-hmm. So the obvious example would be the TikTok situation, which on a variety of levels ended the way that people could predict it could end. The Biden administration, as I understand it, has temporarily shelved the policy issue. But, you know, as of last week, Clubhouse, the newly rising social audio app, which I know that you and the crew have been on, was actually banned from the start in China, which is going to lead to a situation where the Chinese will create their own versions of Clubhouse. Mm-hmm. It's not as if what's been fascinating about the China relationship, because I'd love to get your take on this, is over the past 10 years, the relationship has shifted from, oh, the Chinese, they currency manipulate and they copy and they steal, to, no, like, the Chinese can innovate like very deeply, and that's a change in the relationship. So just looking at all these threads together, at the start of the Biden administration, so we're turning the page a little bit, how do you think the industry should think about China moving forward?
Yeah, I mean, so there's a very good piece was written by Jacob Helberg on this.
We had Jacob on the podcast.
Had him on. Okay, good. Yeah. So Jacob wrote, I think, a very good piece that I think is the argument that I think we should be considering. Which is that he sort of criticized the idea that big tech companies could operate on a one company, two systems model, mm-hmm. meaning that there's the American system and then there's the Chinese system. And if you're a Google or Apple or something like that, you can operate one way in the United States and one way in China. And he questioned whether, and that's basically the approach today. And he questioned whether that approach is stable. So part of the problem is obviously the reciprocity issue, that China doesn't reciprocate. We open our markets to them. They don't open their markets to us. Certainly with respect to social networking apps and things like that. You also have the problem that there are strings and conditions attached to even being allowed access to the Chinese market. Yeah. China, the CCP, have been much more strategic in how they use their market access. In other words, if you're going to be granted access to the Chinese market, there are certain rules that you have to abide by. And I think the whole NBA episode with Daryl Morey, right, exactly. Right. And so that was a really watershed episode, because you had a case where Daryl Morey puts out a tweet supporting the protesters in Hong Kong. It was a fairly generic tweet, didn't say very much.
It was so anodyne. That was the.
It was so anodyne.
Yeah, it was just like Hong Kong.
Right. Right, exactly. But the whole NBA came down on him because they know that that if they want to do business in China, one of the unwritten rules is you cannot criticize the CCP. I mean, that's just the cost of doing business there. And so I think, you know, so one of the issues that Jacob raises is that, you know, what do we have to give up? What are these companies going to have to give up in order to do business there? And then you've got the issue going further on the spectrum of things that make this trade unpalatable is the fact that you've got, what's going on with the Uyghurs, and the larger programs that the Chinese have around social credit and the systems they're building there, and their use of data to within that system of social credit. And so the question is, are you willing to play ball with them and give them access to all the information they want? Which is really the price of doing business in China. If you're an information service, so we saw Zoom. Zoom had this issue where certain conversations got shut down, because then they apologized for it, and the reason why they shut them down is because they had been told by the CCP that certain people using Zoom were dissidents, and they need to be shut down. And so the price for Zoom of doing business in China was being responsive to that type of concern by the CCP. And so I think the point that Jacob's making is that, you know, that for all these reasons, the two systems model is not ultimately going to be sustainable, and that long term, big tech companies are going to really have to choose which system they want to support. And he basically predicts a decoupling, or let's say a further decoupling of these systems and economies. And really, the only question is whether it's a soft decoupling or a hard decoupling.
So this is the question. You just mm-hmm. made the key word. You said they have to choose. Mm-hmm. I've said here for a long time, I'm not sure why we should allow them to choose. I mean, if you're here and you're an American company, I'm not sure why we shouldn't just make you set, why we can just make it very clear to you. It's like, no, it's not going to happen. And I observed this, interestingly enough, I did not see a major statement from Clubhouse, from many others. I was talking with others after, you know, the Clubhouse was banned, and I thought this would actually be an excellent time for the company and others to be able to lean into the idea. They're like, this is an app of free speech. They were explicitly banned after a room which was discussing Uyghur genocide in China. And I won't name who this person is, but they said, look, it's hard to come out there and, you know, defend Clubhouse or talk about Clubhouse being free speech when I'm not necessarily, they didn't necessarily want to be banned in China. Like, they wanted the market access. Any company which wants users obviously wants to do business with China. I don't begrudge them for it. That's their business model, right? So how do we think about that? For example, Travis Kalanick, you can make fun of the guy, but like, he was onto something. He needed to grow at an explicit part of year. He needed to pour money into China to get a ton more users. I don't begrudge him necessarily for that, but as a matter of U.S. foreign policy, there are other considerations to be had. So what do you think about that?
Well, I'm not sure we should treat every company the same. I think it matters a lot what the company is engaged in, what their products are. So, for example, if your product is an information technology that can effectively be weaponized by the CCP, that should be treated differently than if you're selling, I don't know, like a Disney theme park maybe, or even... Or even cars like Tesla is selling in China. I mean, I'm not...
Well, wait a second though, David. Disney mm-hmm. then becomes political. Because guess what? Bob Iger and all these guys have a lot of business there. And then they need to make the Mulan movie but there's and make
no,
more money.
No, you're right.
But that's not a national... But the key thing that I think is becoming clear in David's framework is there's no national security concern with the Disney thing, and there is a First Amendment. No, because like the policy can't be
Disney,
we're mad
Disney
at Bob
allowed, Iger. If they want to do business with the literal agency that imprisons Uyghur Muslims, I mean, that's their right.
Quick pushback.
Right.
That actually is something that could be subject to U.S. law. In the sense of like working. Right. So I just want to say there's something there. But sorry, David, I'll throw
it back to
you.
It's very complicated. Go ahead.
No, I think you're right that that the problem for Disney is going to be that they have to give up some of their freedom of speech, or at least their, let's call it, editorial objectivity in creating their products, because those are the strings attached to doing business in China. Now, the question is, should they be allowed to make those decisions? I would say if their product is not it's not strategic to the United States or our defense or our economy, I guess they could make those decisions, and then we as the citizens of the United States could decide to boycott Disney if they make some bad decisions about free speech. But I think there's other kinds of products that I don't think should have the same kind of choice. I mean, so for example, pharmaceuticals. You know, I think for the United States to allow our entire pharmaceutical supply chain to become dependent on China was an act of insane short-term profit optimizing, as opposed to thinking strategically about what's in the interest of the United States. So I think there are certainly some industries that we need to reshore, you know, and probably the way to do that is just to impose some tariffs on Chinese products so that they can then be made in America in a competitive way, because China does have a big cost advantage over the U.S. But we need to reshore. I mean, certainly in light of COVID, we should be reshoring the pharmaceutical supply chain, the supply chain for PPE. I mean, the fact that we couldn't get enough N95 masks to deal with this crisis, we still can't. You know, that was the solution. If everyone had been given N95 masks in their mailbox We wouldn't have needed lockdowns, and it would have saved the economy untold trillions. So to not have the capability of making these products in the United States is a gigantic problem that needs to be fixed.
The thing that ties us all together, because I'm just turning over the debate we just had about the nature of companies and how they do business. I mean, Clubhouse, it's an app. So I don't even know, if you're talking about the internet, what it looks like to ban companies from having their apps operate in different countries. That's the part where it's difficult. So the thing that ties us all together, and this relates to your conversation around content moderation post January 6th, internet is, we are having a debate as a society and probably as a globe, about what the internet should be and what it shouldn't be. Could you just articulate for us a bit where you think those debates stand, in the sense that a lot of people on the right don't feel like they have access to the public square? At the same time, I was just on Clubhouse with Eric Weinstein, and he was saying that he thinks the Supreme Court needs to make a legal decision on content moderation because of monopoly power. But anyone who knows anything about Twitter knows that Twitter is not a monopoly. It's not a market leader when it comes to advertising. It's not the only method of communicating online. How do you think of these weird legal internet infrastructure questions that no one has quite figured out yet?
Yeah. So, okay. So we're shifting gears a little bit to the free speech issue. I think we've seen over the last few months a real shift in the way that big tech has operated with respect to free speech. It used to be that big tech self-conception was that they stood for free speech, and that they didn't see themselves as players in the political game. They were more like umpires. They were nonpartisan. And I think we've seen a real shift in the last few months. I remember, you know, I was reading this article back when Dick Costolo, he actually said back in, I think, 2012, when he was CEO of Twitter, that we're the free speech wing of the free speech party.
Yeah.
Well, you sure don't hear that anymore, you know? And Mark Zuckerberg gave a speech a few years ago where he said that social networking is like the fifth estate. You know, the media, the traditional media was a fourth estate. We recognize that it could be very disruptive to the people in power. That's why we protect, that's why we have freedom of the press, is to make sure that the people in power don't censor their critics. And he said that social networking similarly was also potentially disrupted. It was the fifth estate, and we had to protect social networking as well. It was basically an argument against censorship. Well, you know, boy, have times changed now, where you've got these social networking companies in the forefront of saying that we need to limit and restrict speech. I don't really buy the argument that, oh, it's just Twitter by itself making these decisions, because this is one site. You can still go to some other site. The problem with that is that all of these sites are making the same decisions, and they're all making the same decision. I've called this a speech cartel. You've got a group of like-minded actors who all think the same way. They all drink from the same monocultural fountain. They all go to the same schools. They're all part of the same socioeconomic elite, and they're all making the same decisions about who gets to have speech rights online. And I wonder, you know, what is the status of our First Amendment rights in a world like this, you know, where the town square has been digitized and is firmly in the control of private corporations who are effectively working together to decide who has access to that town square.
Yeah, well, this is the question, though, on the policy front, because this is where things get very complicated. Like here in Washington, the consensus now on the right, or at least one part of the right, is like, all right, we got to break these guys up. And so that, you know, there's two different coins whenever it comes to this, which I've heard from the tech companies. Mark Zuckerberg famously came here to DC, the Georgetown speech. He was like, breaking up Facebook would make us less competitive towards China, because this is an area where with TikTok, we saw state subsidized, state controlled technology that comes in the United States gains significant market share. I actually think there's a lot to that. But the second thing is, which is that there's no evidence that breaking up Twitter, Facebook, Amazon, or whatever would do anything to solve the problem. And Marshall said this a million times here on the podcast. An AWS run by whatever, I forget his name, the guy who's going to be running Amazon now, but an AWS, which is completely separate from Jeff Bezos's Amazon, would still have banned Parler. Like, there's just no question right. in
the
my mind.
The smallest startup ever would have also.
Yeah, right.
Like,
yeah,
like, your Y Combinator startup would also probably not do it
bingo.
Either.
Seed stage right. startup, which was getting that amount of public pressure, they're going to ban Parler. We all know it. So the question is, how can you actually do anything about that? Like, as somebody who cares about, obviously, free speech, and we do too, about protecting this and more, I don't see any obvious political fix. What I see is, as you said, monocultural fountain over 30 years and, you know, professional meritocracy that has ascended to the top of an industry. And that's just kind of how it is. I don't know how exactly you can fight back against that.
So I agree that breaking up big tech companies won't solve the problem, because I assume that we would break them up along the lines of their business units, their products.
Right.
And so, like, take Amazon, for example. If you so by the way, I still think we probably should break them up, because they've just gotten way too powerful. And it would be probably a net benefit. It probably would be helpful, but I don't think it's going to solve the speech problem for this reason. So you've got Amazon and you've got AWS. Okay, you fork the cap tables. You've now got two cap tables. It doesn't change anything. You got the same executives running these companies. Yeah, right. They make decisions the same way. So, you know, instead of having a speech cartel of five companies, you now got a speech cartel of 10 companies. It doesn't change anything. The problem is fundamentally the cartel. The cartel is what needs to be busted up. And I think the best way to do that, the best suggestion I've seen was a suggestion by Richard Epstein, who's a professor at the University of Chicago. And he said, we need to apply common carrier rules to these big tech monopolies. And the common carrier rules basically says that, look, you cannot deny carriage. If you're a monopoly, you cannot deny carriage to people based on their political viewpoint, you cannot discriminate against people based on their creed.
Right.
I think that's the simple rule that we need here. You know, I think that if you're a gigantic tech monopoly, and it's hard to argue that Google, Apple, and Amazon aren't, I think you have a special obligation not to deny people service based on their viewpoints. And I mean, that to cut to the chase, that's probably the best suggestion I've seen for how to deal with it.
That's a good point.
The part that's so hard is that, and I think your insiders versus outsiders piece that we will link to and everything at Persuasion hit at this, which is there's this huge lack of trust problem in this country, that if we talk about every single issue we're basically talking about, it comes down to a lack of trust, whether that's Gavin Newsom breaking the rules of French Laundry, whether that's Disney and the NBA, and whether it's these speech issues, there's a lack of trust there. What makes this hard for me, though, is I'm worried about the slippery slope in terms of the idea, in terms of other bad faith actors that I don't trust. So, for example, I totally get why you could be even a reasonable center-right person and not trust Jack Dorsey's usually asleep moderation team to make fair decisions. That's right. The reality there. And the thing that really throws that this is actually a thing that happens is, how often do you see a left-leaning mistake on the level of the Hunter Biden effect happen? So this is clearly right. Something we can see this with our eyes. At the same time, though, I can easily see an argument for a Nazi to say, and I'm not just asking this as a gotcha, I'm trying to think through right. The implications, right? Which is, a Nazi actually would say, well, look, you know, belief in, you know, Nazi party ideals are... that's my political belief, and I've never committed an act of violence. I'm not burning crosses in front of anyone's yards. I should be able to do this too. And as we're looking at the common carrier metaphor, it's comparing it to this to right. phones, right? With a phone, AT&T doesn't actually know what we're saying. So if you're Twitter, the reason why Twitter is in a difficult position is hypothetically, and you wrote about this well in the piece, which is that the algorithms only catch so much and you have to comb through it. So I get that part, but at least hypothetically, Twitter could not claim they would not be aware that there was hate speech going on in the platform. So how do we just think through this at a societal legal level? Because it's complicated.
Yeah. So the way I think about it is that if you actually look at First Amendment law, there's actually a whole bunch of areas where the Supreme Court has carved out speech that they've said is not protected speech. It's speech that's dangerous, and they're not going to protect it. And over the last 230 years, the Supreme Court has carved out at least 9 areas where they've said that this speech is not okay, and the First Amendment cannot be used as a defense. One area is fighting words. You know, in the Chaplinsky decision, fighting words. They said, this is not protected speech. You can ban it. I think that we could have a content moderation policy broadly consistent with the First Amendment that says, listen, any racial or ethnic slur, slurs against any particular group, those are fighting words. We're not going to allow it. Okay. Mm-hmm. You cannot incite violence. You cannot yell fire in a crowded theater. If someone is actually advocating for the for people to commit violence or some other crime, you can, under there's a couple of decisions, Brandenburg and Claiborne, you can have a content moderation policy that outlaws that. The First Amendment's not a defense to fraud. I mean, people are not allowed to engage right. in fraud. You can't go online and pretend to be somebody you're not. I mean, if the GRU is creating sock puppet accounts, pretending to be somebody they're not, that is a type of fraud. Just ban it. That's not protected by the First Amendment. We can have an authenticity requirement. And so on the list goes. So My point is that I think there's a perception that if we follow a content moderation policy broadly consistent with the First Amendment, that anything goes. That's not true. The First Amendment does not let anything go. There's all these categories we can carve out. Now, when I say broadly consistent, here's what I mean. I don't think we're going to be able to come up. I don't expect these social networking companies to enforce a true First Amendment court-like standard, because they're a company and there's millions of posts, there's billions of posts. They're not going to be able to apply a court level of evidence. So take, for example, defamation. Okay, defamation is not protected by the First Amendment. You should not be able to defame people on social media. If somebody reports to Twitter or Facebook, hey, there's this post over here by this person that's defaming me, we don't need to conduct an inquiry into whether that post may be true or not. I mean, the reality is, if that post is facially disparaging to another user and they're complaining about it, just take it down. You know, we're not going to convene a jury. Okay. So that's what I mean by broadly consistent is, look, we're not going to, you know, we're going to acknowledge the situation here, which is these are social networking sites. They've got billions of messages to moderate. But what I'd like to see is that the principles of the moderation come from 230 years of Supreme Court case law, as opposed to these companies just making it up. And that's what they're doing right now, is they're completely making it up. And I see a lot of people on, who disagree with me saying, oh, you know, David, all these bad people who are getting censored, they're getting censored because they broke the terms of service. You know, if they just followed Twitter or Facebook's terms of service, they wouldn't be getting banned and taken down. I'm like, well, I've written a bunch of these terms of service. I know what they all say. They're 20 pages long. They all say the same thing, which is we, the company, can do whatever the hell we want. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's what every terms of service says, is you can only use this service if you agree to waive all of your rights. The terms of service is not a protection of your due process using any of these services. All they do is you waive all of your rights when you use these services. That's what the terms of service says. So they're not a protection of anybody's free speech rights. And what I would like to see is that we do have some rights restored to us in cyberspace. Because what basically happened is, you know, when speech got digitized, the town square got privatized, and the First Amendment got, I don't know, euthanized, I guess, just to make it rhyme. But basically that's what happened is the First Amendment doesn't apply to private corporations. So they basically can just do whatever they want. And to me, that's the problem, is we need to have some rights as citizens to speak in the town square, which is now online. It can't just be all completely controlled and owned by private corporations. And that's what I'd like to see changed.
So but I definitely have half of the audience right now screaming, ask him about Section 230. Someone is saying it. But this is what I find. But David, this is what I appreciate about your thought on this issue, which is that it's kind of heterodox within like the free speech side of the debate, because your position isn't purely, oh, yeah, and then let's just end Section 230. Can you just sort of crescendo that with, what is your approach to Section 230, the distinguishing there? I think it's like the mend it, don't end it idea. Because, and this is my frustration with debate. If you look, I don't know if, did you see Mark Warner's Section 230 bill, Virginia Senator last week?
No, so I haven't. But
his bill is the exact opposite of every single thing you're asking for. So I hate when people say, oh, there's this bipartisan alliance against big tech. It's like, no, Senator Mark Warner actually wants Jack Dorsey to censor more even more. So the Section 230 issue is complicated. So I'd love to just get your final thoughts on that bit of this.
Yeah. So I believe that we should mend Section 230, not end it. There's actually a pretty good article in the American Conservative by Rick Santorum who gets it, who basically said what I've been saying, which is if you're just completely abolish Section 230, what 230 is a liability shield for online service providers. It basically says that as long as they're not the ones creating the content on their platform, if they're just a distribution platform for the users to create it, then they're not going to be held liable for what the users say. Go after those users. If one of those users defames you, go sue them, not Facebook or Twitter or Yelp. Okay, this could apply to restaurant reviews or Google, you know. And I think there's some sense in that, because the reality is that if these online platforms were liable for every single thing said on their platform, corporate risk aversion would drive them to take down any content that could potentially cause them any liability whatsoever. And you will get far less speech, not more speech. That's the thing that I think we should be very concerned about. Section 230 actually has two provisions, and they're both worth going into. So provision one, I think it's 230C1. That's the liability shield. It basically, yep. and the liability shield it's based on an offline. It's based on how the world works offline, and so imagine you've got a publication and a newsstand. Okay, so what section 230C1 says is there's publisher liability and distributor liability. If you're a magazine and you defame someone, you're liable as a publisher. But the newsstand on which your magazine is sold, well, they're not liable for what happens in that magazine. Because if they were, there wouldn't be very many newsstands around. The newsstands would very quickly go out of business.
There aren't any more newsstands
around. There aren't any more anyway. Yeah. But the same is true for these online platforms, right? Is that if you were to hold them liable as the publisher just for distributing content, you would very quickly not have very many distributors, and that would lead in a net reduction of speech. But here's where the problem comes in. The whole problem with Section 230 comes from C2, which is the second provision, which is the Good Samaritan provision. And what it said is that if what the legislators were concerned about, this was in 1996, and people were the legislators were very worried about online porn and filth and even violent video games and natural born killers was the big moral panic at the time. They were very worried that that if they gave this distributor liability shield to these online companies, they'd have no incentive whatsoever to take down porn or violence or filth or what have you. And so what they did is they created the C2 provision, which is Good Samaritan protection, which says effectively that if these online service providers take down offensive material, that they will not lose the liability shield. And so that was the balance that they came up with. Now, that's what's created all the problems, because C2 says they can take down the offensive content even if that content is protected by the First Amendment.
Yes.
And that is where the whole problem comes from, is because it's allowed the big tech companies to have their cake and eat it too, which is to say they've got this liability shield, but they can also act as publishers. And that's what we saw, for example, with Twitter when they censored the New York Post story about Hunter Biden. They were basically saying that we know better than New York Post. We're going to replace the New York Post editorial judgment with our own editorial judgment, which was quite stunning. And yet they're not subject to publisher liability. And that caused Senator Tom Cotton came out after that and said, listen, if you're going to act like publishers, we're going to treat you like publishers. He's right. I think he's right about that. But the answer is not to just wholesale repeal 230. I think you could see that the problem is that it won't just be the Facebooks and Twitter that are hurt by that. Mm-hmm. It'll be, you know, services like Gmail and Yelp and Reddit and every comment board on the internet, and lots of small innovators are going to lose their liability shield and they're going to get sued into oblivion. So I do think that we got to be really careful about how we fix this. And you know, I think Republicans need to think really hard about why it is that Democrats support repealing Section 230, and specifically the Democrats who've been calling for the most censorship on social media sites like Blumenthal, Most want to get rid of Section 230. Why is that? They're trying to lead Republicans into the briar patch on this issue because they know it's going to lead to more censorship. And so you can't just straight repeal 230. You got to fix it.
It's a whole other podcast. I'm just imagining Wall Street Bets without Section 230.
Yeah,
how with Reddit, that would have Reddit that would have turned out.
Goodbye.
Reddit would have been sued by Melvin Capital and Gabe Plotkin would have been made a lot of money.
Right.
Exactly. It's all crescendo. This is my last question for you, David, which is that you're thinking about free speech, China, and all this stuff really deeply in the technology industry, something that we really deeply support here and we want to elevate. As a more broader question, how do you think about rights in the digital space? Just as somebody who invests in these, you know, companies and thinks about rights or thinks about users in the platform, how do you think about like American right or not even American user rights on the platforms and in cyberspace? What does that look like?
We don't have any. We don't have any rights. And I think that's fundamentally the problem, is that many of our rights as citizens come from the fact that Congress is not allowed to make any law that abridges the freedom of speech or of to peacefully assemble. Our rights are really, most of them are protections against some government action abridging our freedoms. And the reality is we're now in a world in which these big tech companies are as powerful as any government, but they're not restrained in any way by a Bill of Rights. We don't have any protections. And I think that these big tech companies, now the reason why we tolerated that situation for so long is that these big tech companies said, no, listen, we don't want to have influence over the public debate. We are simply neutral speech platforms. We are not partisan. We're just umpires. We're going to be fair to everybody. But I think what you've seen over the last 6 months is we can't really trust big tech. We can't take big tech at its word. They are influenced by political pressure and political forces like any other corporation. They're influenced by boycott campaigns. They're influenced by the Senate Judiciary Committee threatening to break them up. They're influenced by letter writing campaigns of their own employees. And you've seen them increasingly given to these pressures to take sides on various kinds of partisan issues. And I think given that fact, we can no longer trust them to be neutral umpires. We can no longer entrust our free speech rights to be in the hands of these private corporations who at the end of the day are going to cave to anything on any issue that they perceived is in their financial interest. So again, I would like to see some reassertion of our rights in cyberspace. And I think it's going to take, I don't know if that's going to happen in the next couple of years, but that's ultimately where I like to see this thing, the direction I like to see this head.
I need to send that clip to Andrew Yang. He'll immediately come out with like, we need digital cyber rights. I can already see him doing it. David, really appreciate you joining us. It's been such a great episode. Everybody go and subscribe to All In Pod, where David can be heard all the time. He's a great follow on Twitter as well. So thank you for joining us.
Really thanks, guys. Yeah, really thanks, appreciate David. It. Thank you. Yeah.
Hope you guys enjoyed the episode. Once again, a humongous thank you for supporting us for the first 100 episodes. Stay tuned to the Substack for all the exciting things we have coming down the line. And a huge special thank you that we'll be inserting from now on. Thank you to Phil Hegseth and Embassy and Third Productions for supporting our work and editing these episodes literally at the last second, pretty much every single week. Everyone is going to get better offerings as we get bigger and go further. And last but not least, huge thank you as always to the Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We're really excited to have them as a partner and to continue moving forward. See you all on Thursday.